Good morning, Carolinas. You're listening to Carolina Focus on News Talk 1110 99.3 WBT, Mix 1079, and 92.7 610 Sports Radio WFNZ. Carolina Focus is your public affairs show. It's a combination of original interviews and choice encore segments from this past week. We're your co-hosts, along with Sharon Thorsland. I'm Ed Billick. Well, let's get started. Something new at Davidson, Sharon? Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Ed. Well, this new exhibit is called Unshadowed Land, and it celebrates the resilience of indigenous people that lived on and farmed the land that is now Davidson College. There's going to be a guided walking tour of the exhibit this coming Saturday morning. If you're interested in it, you can register for the event on the Charlotte Museum of History's website. Well, the artist who created Unshadowed Land is named Nicholas Gallinan. He started the outdoor project last fall. It began in November with Davidson volunteers tilling soil in the shape and scale of the Andrew Jackson Monument that is at Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. So this exhibit that Gallinan started is outside the Catherine and Tom Belk Visual Arts Center here at Davidson. This spring, volunteers prepared the soil for a spring planting of corn. Now, you might think, what does this have to do with art? Well, Gallinan says his work aims to expose how colonialism resulted in the misappropriation of and profiting from indigenous art and culture.
This work engages the histories of how people relate to land and place and to these stories and to land acknowledgments today, to land back movements, to the difficulty of really transmitting participation in this, you know, colonial settler occupied state of basic calls to returning land to indigenous stewardship, to caring for land with the care that indigenous communities do, etc. So I feel like all that's wrapped into this piece. The land shapes us and it shapes our cultures if we listen. I continually am engaged in that relationship with land and history, and it streams through my creative work.
Gallinan was part of a panel discussion at Davidson recently that also included Professor Rose Stremlaw. She specializes in the study of the indigenous South. She gives a brief history of Davidson in relation to the native people of this region and the colonization of the Carolinas.
The first point that I want to emphasize is that the founding families of this college were deeply involved in the colonization of the Carolinas. And so there's a couple of ways that we can think about that. And first is to understand that in 1700, most of the Carolinas were native homelands. And by the end of the American Revolution, that's no longer true. The change is caused by a series of brutal scorched earth wars that begin in 1711 with what's called the Tuscarora War and continue through the American Revolution and into what's today Tennessee until 1794. No less than William Lee Davidson is part of that process. He earns status and it begins his military career engaging in part of these attacks during the Revolution, scorched earth attacks on the Cherokee lower towns, which are today in Western South Carolina. And so we can think about the process of warfare as interconnected with an equally brutal and violent destruction of life caused by enslavement. Now, some folks in this room are probably old enough to remember learning about the virgin soil theory, perhaps in grade school or high school, and the idea that epidemic diseases introduced to coastal regions of North America by explorers, by sailors, decimated native populations before many native people in the interior saw a settler face. Scholarship in the last dozen or so years on the Carolinas suggests that that's really not true for this region. And the catastrophic depopulation that took place, especially in the 18th century, is a product of warfare. And much of that warfare is associated with enslavement. And that native people who are sold out of Charlestown, now Charleston, many of them taken to British slave posts in Barbados, are part of this larger story of depopulation, but it's disease introduced into Native communities as part of these wars of slavery that also have a catastrophic impact. So by the 1760s, Native people across the Carolinas are signing treaties. And they're doing that in part because depopulation has had a terrible impact on their communities. This is not coincidentally the time where many of the founding families of Davidson College are establishing their farms and plantations in this region. So again, these processes are intimately connected. Now, it's in the aftermath of the American Revolution. The Treaty of Hopewell, which is signed at Hopewell Plantation in South Carolina in 1785, that creates a peace, if you will, between the new United States government and Native people in the South. And this is a very awkward peace at best. George Washington's Secretary of War, a man named Henry Knox, theorized that the United States simply couldn't afford to be at war with Native peoples on its western frontier. And Knox was acknowledging the reality that the United States had a very small military and that Native people, especially those across the crest of the Appalachians, still had considerable military strength. And so Knox envisions a policy that ultimately comes to be called civilization. This is, as I explained to my students, with friends like this, who needs enemies policy, because the idea was that Native people could assimilate and become part of the United States, but they would have to give up their sovereignty, their separate nations, their religions, their languages, their family organization. They would, in other words, have to assimilate into Anglo-American culture. Most Native people were not enthusiastic about this idea. Many Christian missionaries were, and particularly Presbyterians who worked through an organization called the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, the ABCFM. And the ABCFM was supported by donations from Presbyterian churches, including here in the Carolinas. In fact, the first mission to Native people in the South, which also in reference to Nicholas's work, included a boarding school for children, was funded by a tour done by the founding missionary here in the western part of the Carolinas. And so those same folks then who donated the funds to start the college would have been supporters of this effort. So by the 1830s, the shared humanity of settlers and Native people, who many of those Native people as converts to Christianity pray to the same God, is no longer taken as a self-evident truth, including by many Presbyterians. And so we see then when Davidson is established in 1837, and our first student organizations are founded, the debating societies, right? So Phi and Nu, is that the students are immersed in this larger conversation that again, ultimately will transfer to questions over the humanity of enslaved people. But it begins with debates over the humanity of Native people. So it might be interesting for people to realize that these debating societies in the first few years, more than any other topic, more even than slavery, debated Indian policy and Indian removal. Now, again, this reflects larger schisms that are emerging in the Presbyterian church that are going to play out over several decades. But it also reflects some of the local issues that are taking place in this region. So Davidson College was founded by three presbyteries, one of them the Bethel Presbytery in what's today York County, South Carolina, was, it seems from the research that we're doing, established by folks who were involved in defrauding Catawba folks from their land. Now, again, there's lots of debates in this time over sovereignty, state versus federal, but also tribal. But it certainly does seem that the families who were part, again, of one of our founding presbyteries were involved in land fraud against Catawba people. And one of the ways that we can understand this in the larger culture of settler colonization in the South is to understand that white folks didn't see Native people as equal citizens. They didn't see them as having the same rights as they did, and also understood that the legal system as it existed especially in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, didn't recognize the rights of non-white people to their land or to representation. And so the larger religious, social, and political culture in which Davidson College was established was very much a part of this larger culture of Indian dispossession and Indian removal. And so even though the college as a corporate entity isn't directly implicated, certainly founding families were part of this process, but also people in the time of the college's establishment and in those early decades of the college's existence were supportive of the larger processes of Indian dispossession.
That was Dr. Rose Stremlaugh, a Davidson professor who specializes in the study of the indigenous South. So how does that all tie into this work, Unshadowed Land? The artist Nicholas Gallatin sums it up like this.
I reference memory in this process, like the memory of the muscle memory that we might understand when we harvest from the land, the muscle memory that we might understand when we work with our ancestral tools. That's what this work is for me.
You can hear the entire panel discussion on Unshadowed Land on Davidson's website. We appreciate the college's Van Every Smith Galleries for allowing us to rebroadcast portions of the conversation. If you would like more information on the Unshadowed Land exhibit or would like to participate in the guided walk next weekend, you can go to the college's website at davidson.edu. Everybody stay with us. We've got a lot more coming up here on Carolina Focus.
One of our favorite encore segments that we share every so often on Carolina Focus is our cybersecurity expert, Teresa Payton, here with Beth and Bo earlier in the week.
It is the time of the week where we bring on our longtime cybersecurity expert, founder of Fortalice Solutions. You can follow her on Twitter, at Tracker Payton. So whatever we talk about here, if something piques your interest, you can always follow Teresa for all the updates on Twitter, and she's always updating things. And so it's like a never-ending radio segment, as long as you have Tracker, at Tracker Payton there on Twitter to join us. So good morning to you, Teresa.
Aloha, Beth and Bo. Yes, a wonderful time out in Hawaii and back here on the mainland. And gosh, there's so much to cover this morning.
You know what? We're going to go in the Wayback Machine here. I'm curious, people listening out there right now, who still uses Internet Explorer? Now, we can't see the raise of hands, but I know people are driving around Charlotte, going from place to place. There's probably not a whole lot of hands because Internet Explorer is not as prevalent as it once was, which is why, for the first time since 1995, you won't be able to get support on it anymore. The old Internet Explorer, we would call it a search engine. It is going by the wayside today, as I understand it, Teresa.
It is. And I wonder if, absence will make the heart grow fonder here for Internet Explorer. There will probably be some nostalgia for so many people because Internet Explorer, for many, was sort of your first sort of, I'm free to go about the internet any
yes.
way I want to. It was, very much allowing you that opportunity to drive your own navigation versus people who were used to using at that time something like AOL.com, where they had already sort of predefined the internet for you. So it's a very interesting. Microsoft is really, they're trying to play up Microsoft Edge. I don't know how many people use that, but according to the latest studies, the most popular internet browsers today used by people and businesses, Google Chrome is number one, Safari is number two, and Microsoft Edge comes in at a far distant number three. So it'll be interesting to see where things go now that Microsoft can turn all of their attentions to Edge while retiring Internet Explorer.
Now, it's important to stipulate that as soon as I say that it's going by the wayside, retiring is in quotes because it's not going away. Like, if it's on your machine, you can still use it today, but the thing to know is that support for it officially ends today. So basically, you're on your own after today.
Ooh.
Yes, you really are. And so if your business relies upon, here's where I worry the most, is sort of for small businesses and even large businesses, where you may have some type of a back office application you're using, you may not even realize that built into it is Internet Explorer. And so if you are using some type of a software platform where that's your access to the internet, even if it's considered an intranet, The concern is there will be no new releases of privacy and security patches and updates. And that is a very scary idea for me. So people need to be asking their vendors, how are we accessing the internet here if it's not obvious to you? And if it looks like Microsoft Internet Explorer, you need to ask, what's the plan to get onto a new and supported internet browser?
Yeah, that's definitely scary to think about. You know, there's something really scary that I'm thinking about today as apparently Freak Beth Out Day. This story that has been out for a few days about Google's like language model and the engineer who has been dealing with this particular, his name is like, I think, Blake Lemoine, said that this computer, this AI computer, has a soul, that it's a sentient being who could discuss things like religion and philosophy. And now Google has sidelined that engineer. What is what's going on here? Because I feel like we as humans struggle with our own like moral compass and agreement on morality. I don't know how we agree on morality for AI. I don't think we're advanced enough yet.
I agree with you, Beth, and I've tried to read everything I can on this particular story that came out. So there's a couple of things that occur to me here, and you brought up one of them, Beth, that really bothers me, which is we don't have an international, or even in the United States, a national framework set for ethics around artificial intelligence, machine learning, behavioral-based analytics. Now, what could have happened here is they've done such a great job, the engineers at Google, training Lambda, which is the nickname they have for the Google project, done such a good job training with the machine learning and behavioral-based analytics, the software product, that it mimics human behavior. Mm. And the fact that an engineer believes that it's, you know, kind of a conscious software product should really scare everybody, even if Google is correct in saying, well, that's not really what it is. It's just really well-trained. Well, excuse me, I'm not sure I want to interact on the internet without this framework for ethics and guidelines with a software product unless it's disclosed. And so my question is how could this be used not just for good, but how will people with nefarious intent leverage this technology? And the thought of it is frightening.
It's terrifying. It sends chills down my spine.
Well, and it really should, for everybody looking at this. This is something where I would like to see the House Oversight Committee bring in all of the big tech companies and academia and ask them, you know, what are the different projects underway? What are these technologies being trained to do? How are they being trained to respond? And what is our moral responsibility around just because you can? Does it really mean that you should? And what disclosures are we going to require when you're not actually dealing with a human, but with a software product who is trained to behave like a human? These are all questions that have to be answered, and they should have been answered years ago. And now here we are faced with the stark reality of, you know, is it conscious? Beth, I'm not sure about that. But what I can say is it spooked the engineer because it came across as having human emotions and human behaviors, and we should all take note.
Got about 30 seconds. I want to swing it back around to our first topic in a way. You said that the top three search engines today, Chrome, followed by Safari, followed by a distant third, the Microsoft Edge. But Chrome actually has a few red flags as we're talking this morning. Actually, 7 security vulnerabilities that have been announced by Google.
Yes. Update those Chrome browsers immediately, everybody. And when in doubt, when you hear that one of the popular browsers that you use is having issues, besides doing your updates, try using another browser just out of an abundance of caution. If you're not sure, you're not certain, or you're feeling uncomfortable. One of the browsers that was not mentioned that for people who are very privacy-minded that's very popular is actually a browser called Brave. So if you're ever in a place where you're like, oh, I'm just not feeling comfortable and I'm feeling very unsure and I'm hearing there's a lot of vulnerabilities and issues with whether it's Safari or Google or Edge, you could try using an alternate browser in the meantime.
Brave. I've never heard of that one until just now. That's why we talked to Teresa Payton. And you know what they say about this segment, Teresa?
What do they say?
Never robotic, talking to Teresa Payton.
Oh, my gosh. That's my favorite.
Hey, it's good to talk to you. Welcome back to the contiguous. Is that the right word? Is that what Hawaii would be? Did I say that right? Is contiguous the right word, or is it? I don't know if I said it
the
right.
The continental United States. I hear them refer to it.
The lower 48.
What does contiguous mean then?
Well, here.
Can you ask Jeeves?
I have Google Chrome up right now, which I think I need to update after listening to Teresa.
Yes. Can you check that out on Brave? Can you do that for me? All right. Look, we'll look that up, and we'll talk to you soon, Teresa. Thank you so much.
Well, Beth and Beau, be safe out there.
Thank you, Beth and Beau and Teresa. And now to wrap up the first half of Carolina Focus, some great news from Levine Children's Hospital, right here in Charlotte, Carolina Focus.
Hello, everyone. Welcome, Levine Children's Hospital. For those that I don't know, my name is Callie Dobbins, and I'm the Senior Vice President for Atrium Health Levine Children's. And today is always one of my most favorite days ever at Levine Children's Hospital, and I hope you all are as excited as I am. Certainly none of today is possible without our patients, their families, and our community, who each and every day trust us to provide the very best care for their loved ones. As we come together today, we recognize and celebrate our amazing doctors, nurses, clinical teammates, and healthcare heroes for not only offering the very best and most advanced care, but also for the personalized touches that they provide our pediatric patients and their families each and every day. We also celebrate our brave patients, many of you that are with us today, their loving families, our donors, and this incredible community who, since the days we opened in 2007, have never wavered in their commitment to us. It truly is an honor for each and every one of us at Levine Children's to care for you and your families. Everyone who walks through these doors inspires us to be the very best we can be. You make everyday moments extraordinary. As I reflect on the last year, I remember those everyday moments that became extraordinary moments. Those moments that make Levine Children's Hospital the very best place to care, the very best place for hope and healing, and the very best place for you and your family to receive care. Yes, like every year, we have faced our challenges and our changes, but we've also celebrated some very special times. Like when baby Anair, whose care team had the chance to take them outside for the very first time after 250 days to see their first sunrise, or Nurse Bill, who made sweet Briley a special cake to celebrate her one-year anniversary of her kidney transplant. She loves unicorns, and Bill wanted to make sure that that cake was made specially for her. It was good. I love that it was good. I think of 17-year-old Amina, who experienced depression, anxiety, and thoughts of suicide before she began therapy in our school-based virtual care program. Now, look at her. She is thriving, touring colleges, and excited about her future. I'm also reminded of Ben Ben and the talented care team that enabled us to give him a new heart, along with 18 others. That's 19 pediatric transplants in 2021, the most in the East Coast, giving 19 families another chance at life. And certainly, as always, transplants don't happen without the selfless gifts of our donor families, which we're also incredibly grateful for. Congratulations, Ben Ben. You see, it's these moments why today we can invite you to join in with us to celebrate our amazing medical teams for their hard work to provide the very best care for children in Charlotte. Because of each of you, we have more kids ringing our victory bells, more birthdays to celebrate, and so many milestones that families get to have, all because of you. Let's give our Levine Children's Team a round of applause. So are you here to celebrate what we're really here for? Are y'all ready for it? As always, I am incredibly excited and proud to share with you some amazing news today. So here we go. For the 15th consecutive year, Levine Children's Hospital is a U.S. News and World Report Best Children's Hospital. And not only are we ranked in multiple specialties again, we remain the only children's hospital in this region to have these badges of honor. And for the third straight year, here we go, we are ranked in 8 pediatric specialties. Before we unveil each winning specialty, I would like to introduce Ken Haynes, Executive Vice President and President of the Atrium Health Greater Charlotte Region. Although Ken cannot be with us in person today, when he found out about this announcement, he knew he wanted to join in this celebration. So let's take a listen from Ken.
Hello, everyone. As Callie said, I'm Ken Haynes, Enterprise Executive Vice President and President of the Greater Charlotte Region of Atrium Health. Unfortunately, I cannot be there in person today, but I could not miss the opportunity to recognize this incredible honor of being ranked yet again in 8 pediatric specialties. I continue to be amazed by our Levine Children's doctors, nurses, and care teams. You truly deserve the recognition and honor because of your dedication, your commitment to excellent care that's been recognized for 15 consecutive years. As a leader of the organization, this news makes me incredibly proud of what the team here has built, not just for Charlotte, but for those all around the world who travel here for care. Personally, as a parent, I know without a doubt that if my children or the children of anyone that I know need help, the first and only place I would consider bringing them is Levine Children's Hospital. Quite honestly, I do that a lot with our kids, friends, and parents. You want only the best for your child, and I can truthfully say that every family who walks through those doors receive the best care from the best team. On behalf of myself and the entire leadership team at Atrium Health, congratulations everyone at Levine Children's Hospital. We thank you all for your leadership to create a top children's hospital, the only one in the region to receive this distinction. Above all, we thank you for the compassion and support you bring forth to our children every day. Thank you so much for what you do, your dedication and sacrifice. God bless.
Thank you so much, Ken. Now I would like to invite Dr. Drew Herman, our Chief Medical Officer for Levine Children's Hospital, to share a few words.
Thank you, Callie. Good morning, all. My name is Drew Herman, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Levine Children's Hospital. And my role gives me the privilege to watch and assist our teams as they care for kids with the greatest compassion and skill. I'm incredibly proud of the work being done by our doctors, nurses, and team who inspire us each day. And it's truly a privilege to work alongside them and witness their passion and utmost dedication. Now, I may be biased, however, I'm pretty sure I'm right. But I've never seen a team of teams so consistently remaining dedicated to every single patient. As a parent myself, we're grateful to our families who have helped shape who we are and what we stand for. As Callie shared, we wouldn't be celebrating this day without each and every one of you who've let us stand by your side. None of this is possible without your trust and your support in us. And so from our family to yours, thank you.
All right, thank you so much to everyone who has joined us and watched in virtually and in person. We are so excited to be recognized as a best children's hospital in Charlotte and for being the best for our patients and their families. I hope you can feel how proud I am to be a part of this team.